China pledges to continue advancing its comprehensive strategic partnership with Russia to a higher level. Lebanon's political crisis drags on after the country's president and prime minister-designate failed to agree on the formation of a new government. And the Turkish lira collapses by nearly 15% after President Recep Tayyip Erdogan sacked the country's central bank chief. Thanks for joining us. China has pledged to further advance its comprehensive strategic partnership with Russia to a higher level amid heightened tensions with the United States.
Lavrov's visit to China will further consolidate the good momentum of high-level development of China-Russia relations and keep closer strategic coordination in international affairs. China stands ready to work together with Russia to promote the development of the China-Russia Comprehensive Strategic Partnership of Coordination for a new era in a wider scope and broader areas and at a deeper level.
The Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov held talks with his Chinese counterpart Wang Yi in Beijing on Monday. Before leaving for China, Lavrov told reporters that Moscow and Beijing should replace the U.S. dollar to protect their economies against Western sanctions. Lavrov accused the West of trying to maintain its domination over the global economy and international politics at any cost, including through sanctions. Washington has vowed to take fresh anti-Russia measures over its alleged intervention in the U.S. presidential elections. The U.S. is also locked in a series of disputes with China over Hong Kong, Taiwan, and the South China Sea, among other things. Political commentator Anar Tangen says it's a third rail in politics to push powers together, and that is what the U.S. is doing.
He's facing a situation, especially with China, which where it will be the main element in the next midterms and also presidential elections. The one thing that everybody knows is that China will be stronger and the U.S. relatively weaker in 2 years and also three. So at that point, the Republicans plan to use this as a bludgeon. You already see Pompeo comparing China to Nazi Germany. And it's strange because generally the third rail of international politics was trying to keep the three powers from, you know, two siding against one. In essence, pushing Russia and China together is not dealing from a position of strength, but opening yourself up in terms of weakness, especially when it comes to the currency. If, in fact, China and Russia go their own way, as does Europe, who's also been bothered by the U.S. Use of the SWIFT system, this could be a disaster for the U.S. economy.
Beijing has announced sanctions on 10 European individuals and four entities, retaliation for similar restrictions imposed by the European Union against China. The Chinese Foreign Ministry said its blacklist includes the head of the European Parliament's delegation on China. The ministry said its countermeasures prohibit the blacklisted people from entering mainland China, Hong Kong, and Macau. It also denounced the EU for imposing sanctions on several Chinese officials for alleged human rights violations. The statement said the EU's move is based on lies and disinformation and amounts to gross interference in China's internal affairs. It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. Ottawa says it is deeply troubled at what it calls lack of transparency surrounding the trial of two Canadian nationals held in China. Canadian Foreign Minister Marc Garneau said that his country continues to work towards an immediate end to the, quote, arbitrary detentions. Garneau also thanked his international partners for their continued support. Separately, the Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau accused China of holding the trials a secret. Former diplomat Michael Kovrig has been detained in China since December 2019. His trial was held one day after the closed-door hearing of another Canadian, Michael Spavor, on the weekend. Both were formally charged with espionage last June. The trials followed Canada's arrest of top officer of Chinese tech giant Huawei in 2019. Robert Fantina is an author and journalist joining us from Ontario. We also have Tony Gosling, who's an investigative journalist, joining us from Bristol. I'd like to welcome you both. Let me first start with you, if I may, Robert Fantina. Given the fact of what Canada has done in terms of its arrest of the Huawei official, do you think that China is getting back at Canada for doing this?
It's very possible that it's a kind of a tit-for-tat situation, and this is not something that the world diplomatic environment really needs at this time. China, of course, should be more transparent in its trial of these men. But again, are they pawns in a political game between Canada and China? That's very likely. It's also interesting that the United States has come in favor of the Canadians and in opposition to what China's doing, when, of course, the United States holds its own political prisoners and tortures them in foreign rendition sites. So it's totally hypocritical of the United States to be involved in this in any way. But yes, certainly there needs to be more transparency, and these men deserve justice, whether they are guilty of spying or not. Whatever it is, it should be publicly made known to the world.
Well, Tony Gosling, when we take a look at this, is China also taking into account the way that the U.S., based on reports and as our guests there indicated, maybe has directed Canada to make that arrest, and therefore is of the Huawei official, and therefore it has reacted to this with that in mind also?
I have been accused many times of being a conspiracy theorist when I suggest that perhaps, as John Pilger has suggested, that there is a war being cooked up here between the West and China. Because if the Canadians, and let's face it, NATO, which they're part of, wanted to defuse this situation, if they cared whether or not Michael Kovrig and Michael Spavor are allowed to come back home, and I'm sure they would be released immediately, there's a very simple thing they can do. They can release Meng Wanzhou, who, by the way, was grabbed just at the airport in Vancouver when she was making a transit flight back in December 2018, even though she's the chief deputy chair of Huawei and also their chief financial officer, one of the most important companies in the world. So if they actually want to do something to defuse international tension and to get their two Michaels released and back to their homes, to their families, etc., it's a very, very simple thing to do. Release Meng Wanzhou. And I don't think they're going to do that, because I believe I'm right. I believe there's deliberate attempts here to ramp up tension between these two massive superpowers by what we can only describe as a bunch of maniacs, really. People who are actually doing their best to set off tensions between these global superpowers, because they believe that they can make some sort of either more money or gain more power from the ensuing chaos, as some did in the run-up to the First World War and the Second World War, by actually setting big powers up against each other.
So if we're looking at that type of scenario, Robert Fantina, is that the end game, do you think, that the U.S. is after? And if so, this confrontation, which could take a military scope to it, what would it want from China in return? I mean, at this point, the U.S. is on the back. It's not able to catch up with China, for example, when we take a look at the technological front. But it hasn't really said anything except to stoke tensions, for example, in the East China Sea with China on a variety of issues.
Yes, and I agree with what your other commentator has said, that the United States, of course, is only looking for increased power in the world and increased profits for the oligarchs who run the United States. And a confrontation with China would certainly possibly bring that to pass. However, the catastrophe it would cause for the world is beyond the imagination. I hope that cooler heads will prevail, that this current situation will be diffused, and that future similar situations will not occur. Because what it would mean, another major war would mean for the world, would be just unspeakable. It's I can't even comprehend the destruction and the suffering and the chaos that would result from that.
Tony Gosling, if we're looking at a military-type confrontation, our piece of news, of course, is talking about Canada here, but also then we can, as we've been discussing, the U.S. coming into the conversation. Are there going to be other countries on board with the U.S. when it comes to China?
Well, I don't know that there will be. I think that there is some pressure to put some of the European states on, and there has been for a long time with Russia. We easily forget that the role that the treacherous mainstream press in the West has been playing here. For example, the withdrawal of the Russian ambassador to Washington for the first time, as far as I know, ever, certainly since the end of the Soviet Union, is virtually unreported here. So these moves, which are taking place, which are bringing us closer to war, the Western media is turning a blind eye to these things. And also, they are reporting very one-sidedly on this tit-for-tat between Meng Wanzhou's detention and Mike and the two Michaels' detention over in China. So the media has a very heavy price to pay here, in that they're trying to keep the Western public in the dark. Thankfully, we're not doing that here right now, but much of the Western media just ignores the two sides to this. And also, very important to note that all of the initiative in this is being taken by the United States and by the West. So the moves are reactions by China, including, by the way, the expulsion of journalists that's been going on over the last few months too, has all been as a reaction to moves by the United States. So although the United States likes to think that it can keep the public bamboozled with the CNN, the BBC and the rest of them, actually it's quite clear to anybody that's paying attention that all of these evil chess moves are being made by the United States, and all that China is doing is just responding as it has to do. It cannot ignore moves like the effectively kidnapping of Meng Wanzhou, one of their most important and precious executives and business people in the race for technology. And it's a race for technology that the Americans are not just losing, they've lost it. They cannot compete with China on international markets, and so they're using underhand tactics and potentially putting millions of people at risk because they've lost what is effectively a battle for technology and to be able to produce good items at a cheap price and at a competitive price. They have lost. So that's why they're doing these sorts of things, I think, is because they're bad losers, basically.
Okay, we'll leave it there. Thank you very much, Robert Fantino, author and journalist from Ontario, and Tony Gosling, their investigative journalist from Bristol. Many thanks. And that brings us to an end for the news review. Welcome back. Lebanon's political crisis drags on, with no agreement reached on the formation of a new government. The Lebanese President Michel Aoun met with the Prime Minister-designate Saad Hariri on Monday to discuss the issue, but Hariri said that there was no agreement on a new cabinet. He said that Aoun insisted on a blocking majority in the next government for his political allies. Hariri was tasked with forming a government for a fourth time in October, but has failed to do so due to political differences with President Aoun. Lebanon has been without a government since August 2020, as the country remains grappling with both political and financial crises. Mariam Saleh is a correspondent who joins us from Beirut. Not good news, Mariam. Tell us more details behind why this government is not being formed and what the differences are.
It's absolutely not good news, because we were under the impression this week that there would be a good anticipated meeting, that we would probably have at least a skeleton for a formation cabinet. However, today, all those hopes that we had for today have been lost. We saw even in the weekend some good news where we saw the price of the dollar seemingly decreasing. We didn't see blocked roads. People were hoping, like we said, that there would be some sort of an agreement, if we may say, on the type of cabinet that we will see. It seems that we still have those very deep differences between Prime Minister Saad Hariri, designate Saad Hariri, and President Michel Aoun. Now, as you know, based on the Constitution, both the Prime Minister designate and the President have to agree on how the cabinet is formed, and not And it cannot be done unilaterally. The prime minister cannot do it alone. The prime minister said that he felt that he was, he didn't say it like it is, but he was somewhat insulted that the president sent him a list which included names of ministers that the president suggests, and that would give him veto power. Some people call it blocking one-third majority. Some people call it veto power in the cabinet. And we've heard also from the group that supports President Aung, basically the Free Patriotic Movement, saying very clearly they do not trust a cabinet that would be led by Prime Minister Saad Hariri because of the experiences that they had with him. Prime Minister, on the other hand, considers that this is not constitutional, that the president, that the prime minister does not have to fill in names for with certain lists based on certain standards that the president sets. So this is why he said that I will consider this suggestion by the president as if it was not even given, and that we have to go back to the fact that I decide what the number of ministers, the type of ministers that we have. There should be absolutely no political linkage. This brings us to the advice that was given by Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah to Prime Minister designate Saad Hariri. He told him that a technocrat or a cabinet that would be formed only based on experts would not be able to take major decisions without the support of the political groups, and he asked them to get that support, go to consultations with all the political factions, and perhaps that could be a strong cabinet that could help you actually make decisions that are needed for the country. And so it doesn't seem that any of that is happening. Now, there was some talk, sources were saying that international sides, especially Western countries like France, were pushing for a resolution, pushing for an agreement, actually, between the president and the premier. There were also some guarantees from Saudi Arabia that they would not put pressure on Saad Hariri. And as you know, the relations between Saudi Arabia and Saad Hariri are not so good lately. So why all this insistence from both sides, Saad Hariri and president, it's still not clear. What is happening exactly behind closed doors is something that the Lebanese people still don't know about. So this is all we know for now, that they are only disagreeing on the type of government that we should have, the number of ministers, and whether there should be any political linkage by some of the ministers. But from what we're seeing, the upcoming phase is absolutely very dangerous and dark phase for Lebanon, even worse than what we're living right now.
Okay, thank you for that. Mariam Saleh, correspondent there from Beirut. Many thanks, Mariam. On to Turkey, the Turkish lira falls nearly 15% following the dismissal of the country's central bank chief. The currency slumped to as low as 8.4 per U.S. dollar in early trade on Monday. It later recovered slightly, but the Istanbul Stock Exchange briefly suspended trading after the currency plunged more. On Friday, President Recep Tayyip Erdogan fired the central bank boss Naci Akbal and replaced him with former ruling party lawmaker Sahap Kavcıoğlu. The presidential decree did not explain why Akbal was removed, but the move came just one day after the bank increased interest rates to 19% to fight the country's inflation rate of over 15%. At least 60 people have been killed in attacks near Niger's border with Mali and Burkina Faso. According to security officials, the deaths occurred when armed men on motorbikes raided three villages in the Tahoua region near the Tari border area. No group has yet claimed responsibility for the attacks. Last week, 66 people were killed in a similar attack in the region. Violence has surged in Niger's borderland in recent weeks. Security officials blame Daesh Takfiri terrorists and their affiliates for the recent attacks. And that does it for this edition of World News. It's bye-bye for now.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM. From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Close up, Iran.
Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. The second day, Aunt Mahin, then Aunt Atefe, I'll visit her on the third day. Her house is really far from here and I'd lose a lot of time in the traffic. You may ask what I'm doing. Well, I'm writing down the names of my relatives who I'm going to visit during Nowruz holiday. Why? Because it's an ancient tradition. Visiting family, relatives, or friends, literally, e didani, is one of the customs of Nowruz. According to this tradition, firstly, the older relatives are visited. Relatives, friends, neighbors, colleagues, or even acquaintances also visit each other during Nowruz. These visits have no special time and starts from 1st to 13th of Farvardin. These visits may even last until the end of Farvardin. The host or hosts usually return the visit the next day, meaning that they usually go to their guest's home as a revisit the next day. There are also other customs regarding the ancient tradition. In some of Iran's cities, it is a tradition that guests sit around the half-seen cloth and eat the traditional foods of this holiday. These foods include sweets and pastries that are baked in small sizes, nuts, fruits, or even tea and coffee. During Nowruz, the elderly give money to youngsters and children as a gift, which is called AD. Well, this is my first visit today. My grandma was really happy to see me. I got it from the shine in her eyes. She also gave me AD. My grandma always gives us new banknotes, which have been put between the pages of the Noble Quran. And as soon as the new year begins,
She opens the noble Quran and gives the money as a gift to the family members. Oh, I love these nice traditions of Nowruz. Oh, God, how happy I got by seeing Aunt Mahin. It was for a long time that I hadn't seen her and my cousins. You know, visiting relatives during Nowruz is a very good tradition because it strengthens the family bonds. I should keep in my mind that in a new year, I visit Aunt Mahin more than before. And I am now by a hospital. You know why? I'm going to visit those patients in this hospital who are alone during Nowruz. I've also bought a big bucket of flour for them. A flower for each, as a D. These flowers are so fragrant.
Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Gentlemen, this is John. Welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent. Our program aims to address important issues in the subcontinent which affect the governments, people, organizations, and the region of South Asia as a whole. We will try to explain the issues, break down controversies surrounding them, and try to have some external perspectives from experts and people. Please stay with us.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we are going to talk about reports of hype and panic in Pakistan over the repayment of a hefty loan to the United Arab Emirates. Then we explore the impacts of such a move on the economic situation of the debt-ridden country and the future of Imran Khan at the helm of a ship sailing through troubled seas.
In 2021, March was the cruelest month for Pakistan, with April yet to come. Mid-March was the deadline for the repayment of a big slice of a huge loan back to the UAE. Nobody would expect the so-called friend Abu Dhabi to ask for the whopping $1 billion. So the news of the Emirati move sent shockwaves across the country. Deposited with the State Bank of Pakistan, the amount has now reached its maturity, and draining such a volume of money can be the coup de grace for Premier Imran Khan.
Since Abu Dhabi asked Islamabad to repay a $1 billion chunk of its loan, which was due mid-March, there are unconfirmed and sometimes conflicting scenarios about the economic and political future of the country. The $1 billion loan was part of the $6.2 billion initial bailout that helped the government of Prime Minister Imran Khan to avoid default on international debt obligations back in late 2018. Islamabad says the main reason behind the delay in the return of the loan amount is the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic on its already weak economy. And it is true. According to the World Bank estimate, amid the pandemic, Pakistan's real GDP growth has shrunk. According to the State Bank of Pakistan, the foreign debt and liabilities of Islamabad have increased to a total of over $115 billion until December 2020. In addition to the colossal damage of such a move on the country's economy, it will have massive political consequences for Pakistan. Imran Khan is under extra pressure now, as its government has received about $7 billion in gross foreign loans itself in only in 2020 to 2021.
There are many reports saying that the top Pakistani officials have made repeated attempts to reach out to the Emirati Crown Prince, seeking a one-year extension to return the loan. Moreover, many people are certain of a rollover, and some believe that it is again China that will come to the rescue. However, none of the scenarios may lead to a more popular Imran Khan.
For a country like Pakistan, with multiple incidences of internal and external conflicts, Imran Khan has come to be a skilled sailor, since the seas of South Asian politics seldom see the calm. Earlier in March, the captain had to garner a vote of confidence from the lower house of parliament following a surprise electoral defeat on a Senate seat earlier in the week. Khan, who was elected to power in a general election in 2018, is the founder of Pakistan's Tehreek-e-Insaf party that leads a ruling coalition. The party experienced another boost when the Senate elected ruling alliance candidate Sadiq Sanjrani as the chairman of the upper house of parliament. Sanjrani, the incumbent whose candidacy was supported by Imran Khan, received 48 votes, with the opposition's Yusuf Raza Gilani receiving 42. Despite a relatively robust standing in domestic affairs of Pakistan, the fact that the United Arab Emirates has moved to withdraw financial support of Islamabad indicates a widening gap in their bilateral relations. Pakistan doesn't seem to have the money to give back. Therefore, even the prospects of losing such a loaded friend has the ability to induce panic in Pakistan's politics.
Last year, when Saudi Arabia announced a similar demand, Pakistan's all-weather friend China came to Imran Khan's rescue. Thanks to Beijing's handsome help, Pakistan paid back $1 billion out of the $3 billion loan that it had secured back in 2019 to avoid default. Now, many expect China to do another trick and get Pakistan to safe shores again. But why lend money to someone when you're sure of their inability to pay back?
Pakistan's economy is severely dependent on international support. This is why the country is deep in debt with almost no real possibility of payback. The financial assistance packages by Saudi Arabia and the UAE helped Pakistan to buy time to negotiate a deal with the International Monetary Fund, or the IMF. But the implementation of the IMF deal has been itself in limbo for over a year now.
Unfortunately, IMF has totally gripped the economy of Pakistan. And the country, Ministry of Finance and all the financial institutions are acting completely what the IMF want. Because they have, I many times said this, that the IMF have first planted their people. They have given the positions in the current government. There are the key elements and the key figure of the Imran Khan government are the people who were the employees of the IMF previously. So right now, so it's mean that the country economy has been hijacked by IMF. And currently, the situation is getting worse and worse. And if the situation goes on, I think that the country is going towards some sort of the major bankruptcy.
Pakistan returned the Saudi loan by securing three different financing pipelines from China. Beijing gave Islamabad $1 billion as soft loan, a credit swap financing line of $1.5 billion and $500 million commercial loan from the Industrial and Commercial Bank of China. The Chinese assistance helped the State Bank of Pakistan maintain the gross foreign exchange reserves of around $13 billion. Currently, the Pakistani government is trying its best to revive the stalled IMF bailout program. As part of the IMF conditions, the government is amending clauses in the State Bank of Pakistan Act of 1956 on the definitions of the monetary liabilities of the central bank.
The IMF has a plan that how to suck the blood of the people and how they will take all its control into the institutions, because this is a strategy. When IMF want to cripple the economy of any country, or they want to put the country towards a bankruptcy, they use such kind of the tactics. So similarly, if I will give you an example, that how what's going on in Lebanon now, that their economy is moving towards the barter system. So that is horrible and alarming. So we can see the similar situation is going in Pakistan, because the major sectors of the economy who were the source and the revenue generation sources, they have almost finished. So in that condition, Pakistan economy has been handicapped by IMF by planting their own people into the Pakistani government.
A rollover may be able to postpone Islamabad's problem for some time, but the media frenzy over the UAE move was indicative of Pakistan's strategic significance in the geopolitical alignments of Asia and the entire world. Saudi and UAE pressure is pushing Pakistan towards China, as well as perhaps Iran and Turkey, something the United States and probably India never like. On the other hand, Washington needs Islamabad to keep its foothold in Afghanistan, which is itself getting closer and closer to China. Pakistan is a centerpiece in many of the regional puzzles that we have today.
The network of political alignments around Pakistan is complex, and any slight shifts can lead to big consequences. The recent row over the return of UAE's loan further proved the case. Pakistan is among the rare countries in the world with cordial ties with both China and the US. Washington needs it for better reach in Afghanistan, and Beijing needs it for access to the Indian Ocean. It is a good partner to its western neighbor Iran, but has a history of adversary against India, which in turn has historically friendly connections with Iran. Saudi Arabia and Iran can't get along together, but both value their relations with Pakistan. It does not seem to be about the money. By playing the money card, the UAE may be just mimicking Saudi gimmicks to threaten the government, force Pakistan into Israeli ties, or whatever manipulation they deem favorable. But no matter their objectives, unexpected changes in dynamic systems don't necessarily lead to favorable results.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Now, to learn more about this, we are joined by Mr. Kamar Cheema. He's a strategic and political analyst. Mr. Cheema, welcome to this show. So, why has the UAE demanded repayment of its $1 billion loan back from the debt-ridden Pakistan? What does Abu Dhabi want to achieve other than its money?
Well, the United Arab Emirates and the Saudi Arabia has demanded the money back. The reason behind is that when they gave the money, obviously Pakistan was not thinking that there could be other things which the Emiratis and the Saudis may ask. And while Pakistan had to lose the financial autonomy was no more with Pakistan, so the Saudis and the Emiratis want to take away our autonomy regarding the foreign policy choices. So what we have learned through the sources is that the Pakistan has been asked to recognize Israel. So while the Pakistani government has decided not to recognize Israel because Pakistan's founding father, Qaeda Azam Muhammad Ali Jinnah, has made it clear long ago that we cannot recognize Israel and until and unless there is a two-state solution for that. So that was the reason that the Emiratis are trying to pressurize Pakistan, and it's just not the $1 billion which the Emiratis are demanding. The other challenge is that the visas have been banned for the Pakistanis. So the Pakistanis are unable to secure the position in UAE which the other countries can secure. So this is a kind of a challenge that Pakistan had to face by not recognizing Israel. And we had to lose our foreign policy choices. We have been asked to compromise our foreign policy choices because of this.
Wow, really, something really astonishing. So you talked about Israel, of course, but is Abu Dhabi's move somewhere around removing Imran Khan from power? And will he survive such a political upheaval? What are his options?
Well, Abu Dhabi really doesn't want to remove Imran Khan from the power. He doesn't want this, and they will not try to micromanage in Pakistan's politics. They have not been doing it even in the past. But primarily, the choices for Imran Khan has reduced because when Imran Khan came in power, he had to go to the UAE and to the Saudi Arabia for asking money for the financial challenges we were facing. So, and that was the reason that even the International Monetary Fund gave money to Pakistan, that the Saudis and Emiratis were providing us some of the financial bailout plan. So they don't want Imran Khan to come go out of the power, but definitely they want that we should compromise on our foreign policy. For example, Pakistan didn't go to Malaysia when there was a session that was called by Mahathir Mohamad, the former Prime Minister of the Malaysia, to have a session parallel than the OIC. And at the same time, Pakistan has been asked to, that Pakistan is asking the Emiratis and the Saudis to call a special session of the foreign ministers of the Muslim countries so that they can talk on Kashmir. But unfortunately, calling that particular session, we have been facing challenges, and that challenges are that we have been asked to not to rely or not to depend on any kind of foreign policy bailout from the Emiratis and the Saudis.
Mr. Jima, our team has collected a few global media coverages in this regard, and I would appreciate if you could just take a look, and then we can continue. Thanks.
Earlier this year, the International Monetary Fund, IMF, and Pakistan reached a staff-level agreement to release $500 million US dollars as part of the larger loan pact. The year 2019 saw the international financial institution agreeing to provide a $6 billion US dollar loan to the country to rein in the debt crisis in exchange for reform measures. The Pakistani currency hit over a one-year high at 156.99 rupees against the US dollar in the interbank market in mid-March, as flow of foreign currencies remained high compared to outflows. The inflows have kept the currency's foreign currency reserve stable at a 13-month high of $13 billion and strengthened Islamabad's capacity to make international payments mainly on import and foreign debt repayment counters. The analyst said the latest recovery in rupee was partially backed by the reports that the UAE would roll over soft loan worth $1 billion to Pakistan. Islamabad was scheduled to pay off the loan last Friday, March 12th, but the transaction did not take place. Pakistan has found itself in stronger standing with a Saudi-led bloc of Arab nations, having managed to mend a rift while maintaining ties with another alliance with Iran and Turkey that is challenging the Saudis' leadership of the Muslim world. After the Pakistan-Arab League rift emerged in August, Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates asked Pakistan to repay $4 billion in loans taken out in 2018. Then in December, the UAE suspended the issuance of work visas to Pakistani nationals, a move experts said was designed to pressure Pakistan. Out of the committed $6.2 billion, the UAE disbursed $2 billion. It did not make the $3.2 billion oil financing facility and also withheld last $1 billion cash disbursements. Finance Ministry sources had told the Express Tribune that less disbursements by the UAE as against the commitments were because of Pakistan's decision to avail $500 million cash support from Qatar. The UAE has already rolled over $1 billion deposit for another year, which matured in January this year. Despite the drop in global remittances, two of the world's largest recipients of remittances, Pakistan and Bangladesh, registered a rise in flows in 2020 compared with 2019. Pakistanis working abroad sent home more than $2 billion for the eighth consecutive month in January 2021, with Saudi Arabia and the UAE emerging as the biggest contributors to the remittance inflows in recent months. UAE-Pakistan remittances in January 2021 was recorded at $2.3 billion, up by 19% from a year earlier, the country's central bank said. Pakistanis living and working in Saudi Arabia and the UAE contributed the highest inflows during from July 2020 to January 2021, amounting to $7.9 billion in total. A Saudi group that had originally bought the Karachi Electricity Supply Corporation, now called K-Electric, in 2005, has re-entered the scene amid an impasse over the future of the power utilities business relations with the government following the downfall of Arif Naqvi, the British-Pakistani businessman who was the founder and chief executive of the Dubai-based private equity firm, the Abraj Group. The owner of the Al Jomei Holding Company of Saudi Arabia, Sheikh Abdul Aziz Hamad Al Jomei, spent the day on separate meetings with President Arif Alvi, Prime Minister Imran Khan, Ministers for Finance, Energy and Privatization, and some other important stakeholders.
All right, welcome back, Mr. Chima. So, moving ahead, what are the economic and political consequences of removing such a huge amount from the Pakistani economy?
Well, first of all, it will have a direct impact on the foreign exchange reserve, which is very less at the moment. I think around $14 billion foreign exchange reserves are with the central bank. This is the first economic challenge we will face. Definitely, it will have a challenge for any foreign direct investment because if there is no money in the central bank, all the FDI, they keep on looking the macroeconomic indicators, and the government of Pakistan is trying to keep the macroeconomic indicators in a good position so that they can attract the foreign investors. So this is one thing which is definitely going to be a challenge when it comes to economics. But politically, it will have the impact that Pakistan's Kashmir policy has got weakened because Organization of Islamic Cooperation, and particularly the Saudis and the Emiratis, they are not supporting Pakistan on this particular issue of Kashmir. And since they believe that Pakistan is not taking care of their choices regarding recognizing Israel or making or having a starting a debate in Pakistan about the recognition of Israel, so why to listen to Pakistan on that? And above all, the Emiratis, we have been asked, not by anyone, but we have been asked by some of the quarters in the Middle East that we should not be as neutral as we are when it comes to Iran as well. So particularly, I believe that Pakistan's political choices will further be compromised because Pakistan wants to keep a position of neutrality in Middle East, particularly in the Saudi Iran impasse.
Okay, Mr. Chima, the UAE's call happened only after a few months after a similar measure by Saudi Arabia. Are they connected?
Well, it seems that that there is some kind of a connection between the Emiratis and the Saudis on this, because personally, I find that the Saudis were not happy when Pakistan took a stance that Pakistan is not going to recognize Israel. So, and at the same time, we were not supporting the Emiratis and the Saudis on when they waged a war in Yemen, and Pakistan's parliament decided that we are not going to send the troops in Yemen and there will not be any boots on the ground. So this was a very turning point where the Emiratis were not very much happy on this. And somehow the GCC and these Arab countries, they try to have a unified policy on Pakistan, because Pakistan talks to all of these for a support on Kashmir issues. So, and we wanted a collective support from the platforms like Organization of Islamic Cooperation and from the GCC, but unfortunately we couldn't. So there is some kind of a unity between the Saudis and the Emiratis.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chima. Unfortunately, it marks the end of our show. And thank you for your very commendable comments. People have voiced their opinion on social media and cyberspace. And let's just take a quick look.
Faisal Ali Shah said on his Twitter post, "Very challenging situation for Pakistan. UAE demands loan back at the same time as defense and others deal with agreements signed between Israel and UAE. Keep in mind, Pakistan is under pressure also to join Arab-Israel alliance against Iran." Mayank Jindal believes that UAE announces $10 billion fund for investments in Israel after a phone call between Mohammed bin Zayed and Netanyahu. Zayed says $1 billion will come from Pakistan as loan reimbursement and $9 billion will be scheduled investments. Tarun Khanna reacts on his Twitter account and says, "I wonder who will help Imran Khan to pay back the loans and which territory of Pak will be kept at stake." Mansi believes that UAE is behaving like an old Hindi film zamindar, who just wants to have the poor farmer's land and house in return for the loan the farmer took from them. Muslim Brotherhood is dead, it seems. Poor Pakistan.
And that was our episode about the aftershocks of the UAE request for repayment of its big loan from Pakistan and the political dynamics of economic ties between Abu Dhabi and Islamabad. We shall meet next week.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.